today's speaker is Claire Ryan, and she has a BS in Environmental Science and Chemistry from Western Washington University up in Bellingham, and an MS and PhD in Resource Policy and Administration from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And she's currently Associate Professor of Natural Resource Policy at the Lincoln College of Forest Resources and an adjunct faculty member in the Evans School and School of Marine Affairs. And she was just promoted and will be actually a professor in fall. So, congratulations.
Thanks.
So, before becoming a professor, she worked as a scientist and manager for 7 years with the Washington State Department of Ecology and the US EPA. And her research focuses on three areas of applied natural resources science and policy implementation, particularly water resource policy and management, institutional organizational aspects related to integrating science and policy. And the third area is collaboration and conflict management, which of course there's a lot of. And currently she's investigating the integration of scientific information into management decision-making at the U.S. Forest Service and other federal agencies, and continuing to examine watershed planning and restoration processes and programs. And today she's going to tell us about watershed planning in Washington State, a decade of experience.
Claire. Okay, thanks, Bob. If you can't hear me, would you just raise your hand? I'll try to do this without the microphone, but Bob introduced what I'm doing. I realized when they asked me to speak, I've been thinking about watershed planning, watershed policy, water management for pretty much my whole career here at the University of Washington, as well as my professional career working in federal and state management agencies. So not that surprising that I was interested in looking at policies and how those are implemented. So my background is public policy, public administration, and undergraduate degree is much more technical with chemistry. So it's kind of an interesting mix. But I wanted to just talk a little bit about watershed planning, give you a little bit of context, talk about the watershed planning process in Washington. I've also looked at watershed planning in Oregon and some other states, and then highlight a few research findings about the process of watershed planning, and then some of the outputs that is more recent research I've been doing to try to look at, well, what do these planning processes result in? What happens once the planning is underway and completed? And then some ideas for things I want to do next in terms of research. And why do we care about watersheds? Why would we want to do watershed planning? It's too early. Benefits of watersheds.
We need fresh water.
Okay, water provision. I saw a hand over there.
Every living life form.
So humans, fish, we use watersheds for human uses. We use them for biodiversity. Some fish try to go between watersheds. We need water for agriculture. So watersheds are obviously an important focus, yet we don't really have a lot of specific policies that address things on a watershed basis. So just setting that context. The other thing that I'm interested in is kind of planning and decision making. So there's a lot of you that are studying ecosystem processes or hydrology or different aspects of processes that occur in watersheds. And I'm looking at it from the approach of, well, what policies and plans are in place that help us manage or help us decide what to do in those watersheds. And part of the reason I'm looking at the watershed planning process in Washington is that it represents a kind of a different way of decision making, a different way of planning. And some of you have taken classes from me before and are kind of aware of kind of a very traditional administrative procedure. We have a system of government that sets out how we develop laws, how we develop policies, and how we implement those laws. And those tend to be kind of managed and initiated by federal or state or local agencies. who have a policy that they're trying to implement, and they're supposed to then provide some kind of notice and comment that says, here's what we're going to do. And they ask the public, they ask other interested parties to come and give comment on what they're doing. And I've studied a lot of regulatory policy, natural resource policy, and this approach generally is pretty much how we do business in the United States. In the resource world, resource management, it really results often in lots and lots of challenges to those policies. And I could give you a whole other talk on conflict in resource management, but take it as a given that often our policymaking processes are delayed or stalled because there's many challenges. There's lots of disputes, lots of different ideas about what we should be doing. In particular, this one, this picture shows a public land, and a lot of my work has looked at public lands, and there's a lot of conflict about what we do on public lands, lots of challenges, which really makes implementation of those policies often be delayed. And so part of what I've studied and gotten some expertise in, and part of what I was doing in my professional job was doing a lot more collaborative policymaking, a lot more involvement of all of the parties that might be involved in making management decisions. And so this has kind of become a shift in how many agencies, many governments make decisions, is trying to do more of a collaborative environmental management or collaborative approach, which doesn't mean that these agencies are saying, you guys decide, we're not going to make a decision anymore, but that there's a much more concerted effort to involve key stakeholders, key parties, other governments, publics, interest groups in the decision. So trying to identify key stakeholders, trying to do this on a voluntary basis, so there's kind of a regular administrative process, and try to gather people together in different settings to look at issues, look at areas, collectively make a decision, try to seek mutual solutions to problems. It doesn't always mean that those conflicts are resolved, but it's an approach that in some cases has reduced the amount of conflict over decisions and has made it easier to implement some of the management decisions that agencies need to make. So part of what I'm interested in is looking at collaborative techniques for making policy choices. And I'm very interested in kind of how those approaches are implemented. So I was interested when Washington State, in 1998, that's about when I started my faculty job, passed a law that really mandated collaborative watershed planning. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting because much of the theory of collaboration is that it would be a voluntary process. And this policy is still voluntary. It does not require everyone to do collaborative planning. What it encourages is collaborative planning, and if people opt to engage in collaborative watershed planning, they in turn will receive some monetary and technical assistance. So there's kind of an incentive to do collaboration in terms of planning. And so Washington State was one of the first states to pass a law like this that encouraged collaborative planning. Oregon also had a policy that encouraged planning collaboratively. It was designed a little bit differently. But what this law, the Watershed Planning Act, encourages local citizens, local state, tribal governments, and other interest groups to participate in planning for their region. And so it's more of a bottom-up. It's encouraging local governments, local communities to organize themselves and say, yes, we would like to engage in planning instead of having the Department of Ecology or the federal government do the planning for us. So this is another big incentive, is possibly opportunities for local governments to design and make decisions that are appropriate, more appropriate for their local area. What the Watershed Planning Act required was a couple of things. It just said we're not. It didn't just say we're going to give you money, go ahead and plan. It did outline specific things that planning units needed to consider. And the biggest issue in Washington State was water quantity. We do have issues with water quantity, even though it rains all the time here. But if you took planning money, if you organized yourselves and applied for planning money, your plan had to address water quantity, and that's written into the law. There were some other things, some optional items that you could address in your planning effort, including in-stream flows, which are a little more detailed than I want to go into, but the amount of setting regulations for the amount of water in a stream. You could address water quality. You could address fish habitat and storage issues. So there was kind of this one thing you had to do, and then a number of things that were optional. And depending on what you decided to do, you got different amounts of planning money to do these activities. The policy was also interesting in that it listed certain required participants. It said, we won't recognize you as a planning unit unless you have all the counties in your watershed area, the largest city or town, and the largest water purveyor. A water purveyor is somebody that basically sells and supplies water, so they're very much involved in water management. So all of these parties needed to be part of your group. You need to organize this planning unit. Other planning units, and especially the policy was interesting in that it didn't particularly say you had to have tribal governments, and many of you know that tribal governments have co-management responsibilities in our state. And this policy was a little bit odd because it said, well, if all of these parties agree, then the tribes would be invited. And this was not a very, it was an interesting thing. The reaction was that many tribes said, well, we're going to be the initiating government, or some tribes said, why were we not up here? So it's a kind of an interesting governmental challenge there. But there was other parties, obviously public state agencies could be invited. So your planning unit could consist of a number of different parties, and tribal participation was really key in these units because they are co-managers of fisheries which depend on water. And in Washington State, some of you have heard this term WIRA or RIA, depending on where you work, but it's a water resource inventory area. And so the state is divided into these administrative units, and there's 62 of them. And so many of the watershed planning efforts are organized around these water resource inventory areas, or they're neighboring WIRAs that joined together and said, let's become a planning unit. So this is generally an administrative designation. It does not match up with county boundaries, political jurisdiction boundaries. So these are kind of watershed-based boundaries, which is another challenge because you've got different jurisdictional boundaries and different governmental boundaries laid on top of these watershed boundaries. So there's some organization that needed to be done to kind of think about what's going on. I was really only examining the Watershed Planning Act, and there's a lot of other planning activities that were going on in Washington at the time. There was growth management planning. There started in late 90s to be salmon recovery planning. And so what I'm talking about today is really only looking at the Watershed Planning Act, but I did examine some of the salmon recovery planning as well. But generally, this is how, in water speak, people think of WIRAs, and they then also think about counties and political jurisdictions. So if you're not familiar with that, it's a little bit different. And this, I'm sorry if it's so small. The policy, again, I look at this from a policy perspective, and so there's these phases that were outlined in the policy, trying to organize your planning unit, phase one, and then a suggested timetable from the state of in the policy of kind of how long each of these phases should take or how long they anticipated them to take, and then how much funding was provided by the state depending on what you were doing. And so there's kind of each of these represents, and I meant to put little arrows in here, is each of these really represents kind of a hurdle in terms of the planning units organizing themselves. Some of you have been involved in group projects, and you're organized in your classes for different groups. And you know sometimes how difficult some of those group projects are. So you have to start your group, and then you've got to organize yourselves and figure out, well, what data are we going to collect, and how are we going to do this assessment in the next phase? And this phase here was really a lot of the work I did early was looking at how these groups were organizing themselves, how they were collecting and using scientific information, what kinds of information they were using. And then I was really interested in, well, did these groups come up with plans? Were these watershed planning units effective in developing a management plan? And many of the units right now, over 10 years, I think it's pretty clear kind of who's developed a plan and who has not. And I'll show you some of that in a little bit. And we're just now starting into kind of the implementation phase of some of these plans. And this obviously is 10 years later, not 5 years later. So one of the things that became really apparent was that it's taking a lot longer. Some of the timetables in the policy were too short to achieve some of the things that needed to be achieved in terms of getting the planning unit together. And in particular, doing the technical work and developing a specific plan. That was taking a little longer for a number of different reasons. So a lot of the work I did early in this research, this couple of research projects, was really looking at the process of planning. So trying to understand how these groups were interacting with each other, how they were implementing the requirements in the policies. And there's, I don't know if Jackie got here yet, but there's a couple of students here that worked on this and now work at the Department of Ecology in watershed planning, so you can actually take it from academic world and go to the real world and work. But what we found was it was too early to evaluate the effectiveness or the impact of watershed planning, so we really focused a lot on process in the earlier years. And what we found was obviously these challenges that come up, and one of the challenges was participation. And you had those required participants that I mentioned earlier. What was difficult for some of these planning units was to get the participation to encourage either general public, tribes, or other participants to agree to participate in this process. And they really needed some of these key stakeholders to participate, yet it wasn't clear to those stakeholders that there was a big incentive for participation. If you're looking at a 5 to 7 year process of meetings, sometimes monthly, sometimes a little more spread out, one of the biggest challenges was they might have been involved very early on, but how do you keep people involved over time? How do you keep them engaged so that they return and give input back into the process? So this was very difficult, and there was not a lot of funding to help organizations or groups that may not have the resources to fund someone to participate. So this became an issue. That was one of the biggest challenges. I guess the other issue that came up was this issue of trust, and this sounds kind of obvious, but It became one of the biggest barriers to many of those groups. If I go back, one, just the initial organization was, there may have been interpersonal or inter-organizational issues that prevented some units of government, some parties, from being willing to sit down and participate in a planning unit. And so that's kind of an individual thing that in some cases prevented these groups from going very far. And there's a number of different stories there, but this is just summary. So there's aspects of personal, so individuals matter, as well as the institutions. And there's many organizations that have had some rocky relationships. And so here's a policy from the state saying you need to sit down together for the next 5 to 7 years and interact and come up with a plan. And that was, in many cases, an insurmountable challenge for some of these organizations. The other issue that came up was that the policy really had a number of inadequate tools, which is, again, not a big surprise. The timelines I mentioned were pretty challenging. Funding was, it seems, generous, but not quite enough. Many of these planning units used some of that funding to hire watershed coordinators or to hire people to coordinate the planning effort because it's a multi-organizational effort, and nobody really had a staff person that they could dedicate to that. The technical assistance also was an issue in terms of having enough money to do the technical analysis. And many groups said, you know, we just don't have the technical expertise. We don't have the capacity in our organizations to understand what we're supposed to be doing and how to analyze information and come up with a water budget, for example. So some of these units figured out that, well, we need to hire a consultant and that's more expensive. So there was a number of things that delayed and added to the challenges. Yet we also talked to many groups that said, you know, this has really provided a lot of benefits and a lot of opportunities for us that to help establish new relationships, build some trust where trust may have been eroded. And it's really helped us gain capacity. So we've gained some expertise. We've gained some ability at the local level or the regional level to understand some of our own water issues. So there's definitely some benefits, lots of challenges. The other thing that came up, we were trying to look at whether this Watershed Planning Act had helped develop new institutions or new ways of governance in Washington State. And what we found were that, yes, those mandated participants, the ones that were really singled out in the policy, were there. What we really didn't see, and I mentioned this before, was that the public, many of these groups said, we don't know who the public is or how to engage them. And we're not sure if we should engage the public through interest groups, separate organizations, how many people should be the public. You know, the public is just this amorphous term, and they really struggled with figuring out how to represent the public broadly construed. And tribes, in some cases, not all, tribal governments were less represented or not participating in the process. In some cases, the tribes, as I mentioned, were the initiating government or were the lead. So it varied depending on where you were. And I mentioned that, so I'm going to skip that. So a lot of the early work was really looking at how are these watershed planning units interpreting this policy and implementing it to get watershed planning started. And sorry, this didn't turn out as well. So as of about last year, there's active planning or statewide, 40 of those 62 different water resource inventory areas are doing some kind of planning or some kind of implementation. So you see a big chunk of those areas that the state wanted to do watershed planning are actually doing watershed planning. There's about 15, I think there might be one more, but 15 WIRAs are not planning, and I'll come back to that. So they're not participating in this. Remember, this was a voluntary policy. You did not have to do watershed planning under this policy. So it was a voluntary policy. So there was an option not to do watershed planning. And then about 7, maybe 8 now, this is that slice that didn't turn out, started planning but hit some hurdle in either the data collection phase or the plan development phase and decided to stop the planning effort. So different levels of implementation of this policy. And that's just a glimpse statewide. So I mentioned I had a couple of students that were working on this. Two or three did different master's degrees looking at Oregon, looking at Washington. And then the question came up is, well, we now understand kind of the process of planning, but now these plans are starting to be produced. So it would be interesting to look at what is in those plans and whether those plans are achieving some of those policy goals that, that we think the state had in mind. And so at the same time I was thinking this, the National Marine Fisheries Service gave me a call, someone over there, and said, I know you've done some work on watershed planning. Have you done anything with looking at outputs or outcomes? And I said, well, no, but we were just talking about that. They provided a little bit of funding. They were very much interested, obviously, in water quantity, because that's really tied to fish recovery. So if you're going to recover salmon, you need to know that there's enough water to support that population. So National Marine Fisheries Service came to me with a very specific interest in saying, well, are these watershed plans, are they dealing with water quantity? And they were also aware that the salmon recovery planning process was going on. And so they also wanted us to look at those salmon recovery plans, which was a different planning process. So that kind of started a new focus, which has been kind of looking at outputs from this collaborative watershed planning. And so a lot of the literature on collaboration, you know, kind of assumes that if you do some kind of collaborative effort, your end outcome will be superior or better or more accepted or easier to implement. So there's a lot of assumptions about if we do something collaborative, then that end outcome is going to be superior than that traditional process of a government agency making a regulation and trying to implement it. And so this is just kind of a logic model of trying to map out, okay, if you do collaborative planning, what would an output be? And an output is not really an outcome. So I just want to distinguish between those two. In the policy world, we look at kind of what a program does or accomplishes as an output. So what is the work that they do? And in the planning process, one of the major outputs is a plan. And there's many different components to those plans. So we could look at outputs. And then there's kind of this intermediate outcome. If you have a plan, you would hope the plan would be implemented, different projects would be implemented, and then the ultimate end outcome would be that something is improved, something happens in that watershed that's a result of this plan and of this activity. So one of the reasons that we couldn't even look at plans early on is that people didn't have them developed. So we were looking at this process of how do they get from planning to a plan. And then a couple of years ago, there was enough plans to look at that we could actually say, okay, now we can look at that and try to make some links between what we think might happen based on those plans. So the outcome we may not see, we may not be able to measure or assess for many years. But that's really what happens, changes in conditions that might result from implementing the plan. So this study that I did more recently really focused on this piece, which is those plans, and really evaluating those plans as a way of trying to see, are we going down the right path? Are we going where we think we're going? And it's one way of looking at a policy when you don't have monitoring data or other data to measure, is that policy achieving what you think it's achieving? Obviously, the other thing is, if you're not even making a plan, then your capacity for achieving this end is less. So you can really measure, if you were supposed to have a watershed plan that had an implementation plan, if you don't have it, what's the default? What happens when you don't have that? So you may have not achieved. And then understanding, looking at what is in these plans also allows us to kind of think about what are some contents or what are some things that you might want to require in terms of planning if you want to achieve certain outcomes. So we may be able in the future with monitoring data to link some of these outcomes to specific items that were in these plants. So a little bit of a conceptual approach there, but it was kind of the best we could do. And I was very interested in seeing what was happening on the ground, if you will. So we really looked at these watershed plans, and Jason, I don't think Jason Wilkinson is here, but he works now for King County, and poor Jason had to be the one that went and read all these plans. So I have to give Jason Wilkinson a lot of credit, because we just went, and it was a very straightforward looking through the watershed, the water resource inventory areas in Puget Sound, and we were just asking questions of those plans, of those documents. Were the plans developed and adopted? So back in that, in those phases, phase three is plan development. Many of these units developed a plan. Then that plan had to be adopted by the county commissioners, the boards, in those local areas. So some groups got as far as developing a plan, and it may or may not have been adopted at the county level. And so that was a big key of, if you have a plan, has it been adopted? If it's adopted by the county, there's a greater chance that that plan would actually be implemented. If it's not adopted, you have more difficulty implementing the plan, obviously. So we wanted to look at whether those plans were in fact developed. And then there was a lot of discussion and there's been a lot of discussion in kind of the collaborative world about if you do collaboration or if you allow more bottom-up kinds of planning, then local communities will only do the minimum. They'll just do the bare minimum. They won't be as rigorous as perhaps the state or the federal government might have been. So our question was, are these watershed groups in the plans, are they really only doing the minimum, which is just that one required element, or are they doing more? Are they doing more and some of those optional elements? The other thing we wanted to look at were there recommendations? Were there specifics in these plans? Some of you, you know, you write a paper and you can kind of talk in generalities, but we really wanted to see, do these plans have specific recommendations for what should be done? And in particular for the National Marine Fisheries Service, do those plans address in-stream flow? So that was very much their question, is are those plans dealing with that? So if you remember that map, and they had all those other WIRAs, we, in this study, really only looked at the Puget Sound area. So every map I show you now is just going to be this slice of the state of Washington. So these are the WIRAs that we looked at that were Puget Sound focused, and that's really all Jason could get through his 30-some plans for his master's thesis. And so a short, quick results is, were plans produced and adopted? And the answer is kind of. In some areas, yes. Plan content, another big area that we looked at, which elements are present, and we found just extreme variability. So some plans were 30 pages long, some plans were almost 300 pages long. Highly variable, but many of those plans do more than the minimum. So this was an interesting finding, because there's some suggestion that if you allow this to happen at the local level, there won't be more than the minimum. And then looking at stream flow, those watershed plans did not appear to address stream flow very well for salmon recovery. But I need to add a caveat there, is that there was some other planning efforts that were going on. But in terms of watershed planning, low stream flow was not very well addressed. So here, what Jason did is just looked at documents. We did not do any interviews. We didn't do any surveys. He went through the documents and kind of coded the contents of those plans. So as I say, poor Jason had to read all these plans and try to figure out for each area what was addressed. And we tried to code it kind of yes, no, but as you know, sometimes it's hard to make these interpretations. So we set up a coding scheme, and this is only one piece of it, but it kind of showed how we tried to analyze each plan using the same matrix. In the Puget Sound area, we do have 12 plans that were produced. 7 of those plans were in fact adopted. 5 were drafted and not adopted. 6 areas in Puget Sound are not planning under this policy at all. And so this is the Watershed Planning Act, as sometimes you'll hear it called 2514. What we were surprised to find were that 9 of these plans address all of the optional elements. So again, they are doing more than the minimum. And some of them really include recommendations and priorities, which is really what you want to see, is what are the highest priority items and what specifically should we be doing. So this is a little bit hard to read, but this area that's green here, it's kind of where we are. This is the area that are not planning under this Watershed Planning Act. And so the question is this a huge gap here? What's going on in this area of Puget Sound? In some areas, they already had planning efforts underway. There's also about a 3 or 4 county area, there's a large regional water quantity planning effort that's going on. Some areas we're not sure why they're not planning, but this looks somewhat alarming because it looks like nothing's happening, but I don't want you to walk away with that. But there's a question here of what's going on in these areas. Up here, these blue areas, this is where they got as far as developing a plan, but were not able to get it adopted at the local level. And then here's areas where you had a plan that was in fact adopted, and then those are the plans that we looked at to see what else is in those. So high variability here in this Puget Sound area. Remember, the whole rest of the state's over here. But NMFS was very concerned about Puget Sound area for salmon recovery. And that's just planning status. What was interesting, and I mentioned this, is that some groups are going beyond the minimum. Some of the plans that were adopted are in areas where there's a long history of collaboration and planning efforts. And so in the Nisqually area down here, the tribe has been a leader, and 25 plus years of interaction, more than that. I think you corrected me on that, Mike, the other day. There's a long, long history here. Other areas, maybe different kinds of problems. What we don't know is kind of why some of these plans were adopted or why some of these weren't. And so that's one of the next areas we want to look at, is we only looked at the plans. We didn't really talk to anyone in the planning units to find out, okay, well, what happened in this unit that you were able to get your plan adopted, and what happened in this unit that you did not? And I'd also like to know a little bit more specifically about what's happening in that area. The stream flow question, which was the real critical question for National Marine Fisheries Service, is that these plans are kind of vague and general. Yes, flow is important, and we do have problems with stream flow. So they're kind of stating the problem. We were really looking for what are your goals. And so many of these plans identify goals of we wish we had more water, which really, really is not something that the plan is going to help you achieve. Yet, then we said, okay, are there recommendations? And so 7 of those plans actually have recommendations for how they might, quote, make more water. And some of that involves banking, reuse, different approaches for managing water differently. And that's really what we were looking for, is specific recommendations. What we don't see in the watershed planning effort either is a real specific link to ESA-listed species. And that may be because salmon recovery planning was also happening concurrently with watershed planning. So 2 different planning processes that may or may not have been as linked as we would like to see them. Several plans really don't have priorities for in-stream flow. And this was one of the goals that the state had, was that they were really having trouble getting in-stream flows established in many areas. And these plans, this is a really hard thing to establish. So these plans didn't do as well in terms of establishing specific in-stream flows. There's a couple that did and resulted in some new rules, but few. So some policy objectives were achieved, and we're still, this is kind of where I'm going next, is trying to look in more detail at one of the goals was, could we start planning in new areas? And so there's a lot of areas that really weren't doing much at the local level. And in some cases, it appears that this policy did spur that planning. However, if you were a new unit, a new planning unit, new group, it took much longer to kind of get going, figure out different relationships, develop that kind of trust, as opposed to some areas that I pointed out that had more of a history of planning and were more used to working together. So it did spur planning in some areas, but those areas may be some of those areas that ended up disbanding or really struggling. And in fact, yes, plans were developed and adopted, and this seems kind of like a trivial finding, but there had been some suggestion that the entire Watershed Planning Act was a complete failure, and I wasn't willing to go there. And so I was like, I want to see, are we getting plans developed and adopted? And yes, we are. The question is, what is the quality of those plans? And so we are seeing a little bit more than the minimum in some areas. So I'm not on board with some of those that say that this Planning Act is a failure, although it's not a complete success. There are some failures. Obviously, if you didn't adopt your plan, it's less likely that those activities might be implemented and you may not achieve those outcomes kind of at the end of the logic model. So it's unclear if you don't have the plan, what is the fallback? What happens if the plan's not adopted? Are pieces of it taken and incorporated elsewhere? I'd like to look at that. So that's really looking at what's being implemented. What we also see in this area, under this planning policy, is really high variability in terms of what those plans look like. We also looked at the salmon recovery plans, and those have a much more rigid requirement about what those plans have to have. And so those plans look very different than these plans. So high variability, and then really uncertain about what happens with implementation. And stream flows may not be addressed completely in this planning regime. So what I'd like to do is continue this. As I've shown, I only looked at Puget Sound area. I'd like to look statewide and kind of have a bigger sample of planning. We also really need to look at kind of the inner workings of some of these planning units in terms of why we see different kinds of plans and why we see different outputs with different units. And there's a number of different questions I have there about who's participating, who's leading those planning units, and are other interests being represented in those planning units. Obviously, we want to look at what happens with implementation. So if you have a plan, what is being implemented? Where is it being implemented? What kinds of projects are being implemented? And we really haven't looked rigorously at what is happening in that area. And this also suggests possibly some changes, although this Watershed Planning Act may kind of fade out. It's not clear what the funding level is going to be. I think it was a big effort to try to get planning going, but it does suggest some things for kind of how you dictate plan structure and plan contents, just like the requirements for a paper you have to write, what needs to be in that paper, and how do you need to address it. With the variability, we were also kind of surprised that there was such variability. We were not sure what was happening in terms of review and approval of those plans at the state level. So that might suggest something else. I want to leave a little bit of time for questions, so I have to thank Jason, of course. A couple of other articles that are looking at other aspects of watershed planning, but I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know that was kind of a lot of conceptual material, but happy to answer any questions that you might have about planning. Yep.
I'm just curious, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana have all been approaching these issues, at the same time, and in particular have actually been more serious about recognizing tribal rights to water flows and trying to integrate that into water planning and water rights. How how do you see that the comparison of progress in the different states and actually really addressing that fundamental?
The question was about other Western states, Idaho, Oregon,
Montana,
being more explicit about recognizing tribal rights and tribal participation. And I've really only looked at Oregon in detail. Oregon's process is much different, and it does recognize any group that wants to organize itself and call itself a partnership is recognized. What we did find in Oregon, however, were less planning, so not as much assessment, not as much kind of upfront work on understanding water, but lots of projects. And in Oregon, we found, too, that many of those watershed partnerships are really linked closely with conservation districts. And so those conservation districts kind of moved into watershed planning and then used that money for projects, specific projects, which isn't to say that that's a wrong approach. It's just a very different approach than Washington, which said, understand water quantity, then develop priorities and recommendations. It's not clear in Oregon how they're picking projects and whether it has any priority to any particular problem. And I haven't looked at Idaho or Montana. But it's a huge issue with water rights, and many of the rights here in this state are not yet fully determined, which makes this whole discussion when you're planning of how much water is there a very different kind of discussion. Yeah.
The plans that were adopted and successful, are they used as guidelines or structure for struggling?
Well, that's what I don't know. The question was, the plans that were adopted, are those used as example plans for maybe other units? And I don't know that they're used as example plans because the regions are so different, the water situations are so different. What I'd like to do, and I don't know enough about, were there certain things that planning unit did that enabled them to develop the plan and get it adopted that other units might learn from? I don't quite have enough information there to know, but I'd like to look at that. I'd also like to look at those plans and see, as I said, what is anything being implemented. So you might have a plan. Is it sitting on the shelf, or are they actually doing some of the things in that plan? Other questions?
All right. Thanks very much.
All right.